Have you ever solved a complex problem perfectly, like just flawlessly, only to sit back and watch it completely break again a week later?
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly frustrating.
Right. And not because you made a mistake. The intervention itself was a total masterpiece. You executed every single step according to the manual.
Yeah, but the environment surrounding that problem didn't shift a single inch.
Exactly. If you're listening and nodding right now, if you've ever felt that incredibly specific professional frustration where your expertise is entirely neutralized by a broken system, you are in the right place.
Because it really is, arguably, the defining tension of modern professional life.
Oh, 100%.
You see it in software engineering, you see it in public policy, education. We train individuals to this razor's edge of capability, drop them into failing infrastructure, and then we act totally mystified when the outcomes don't improve.
Yeah, but nowhere is this tension more high stakes, or frankly, more clearly documented than in modern medicine. Okay, let's unpack this. Because our mission for this deep dive is to explore a framework that is actively trying to bridge the massive gaping chasm between delivering textbook medical care and actually creating a healthy human life.
And doing it without completely burning out the frontline workers in the process.
Right. The ambitious part is trying to build a system that achieves this without forcing the doctor to become like a politician or a supply chain manager.
You, which is usually what happens.
Yeah. So we are looking at a conceptual manuscript published in August 2026 by Dr. Bechara Saheeli, and it focuses heavily on CanMatis 2026.
Right, the updated Canadian Medical Education Directives for Specialists.
Exactly. For those outside the medical sphere listening, CanMatis is basically the global gold standard blueprint for defining what makes a competent physician.
But this paper takes that blueprint
Yeah.
and completely re-engineers the underlying philosophy, which is what makes it so fascinating.
So what is the author actually addressing here?
Well, they're addressing a structural blind spot that has existed for decades. Historically, medical frameworks operate on this assumption that if you just produce a smart enough, empathetic enough, resilient enough physician, the health of the population will just naturally follow.
Like it's a guaranteed byproduct.
Exactly. But this paper argues that assumption is fundamentally flawed. It introduces a concept called distributed accountability.
Distributed accountability.
Yeah, it shifts the focus from the individual practitioner's brain to the structural realities of the society they're operating in.
So to really understand how this structural blind spot plays out in real time, the paper uses what they call clinical tracers, right?
Yeah, it tracks a specific type of patient journey all the way through the medical system.
To see where the architecture holds up and where it just completely collapses.
Exactly. And the first tracer they use is pediatric asthma.
Okay, let's look at the actual clinical encounter they describe. A child arrives in the emergency room in the middle of a severe asthma exacerbation. They're, struggling for air.
A terrifying situation for a parent.
Absolutely. But the physician on duty does everything perfectly. They quickly assess the severity, check the oxygenation, administer the exact right bronchodilators and systemic therapy.
Textbook care.
Right. And once the child is stabilized, the doctor sits down with the family. They review the inhaler technique, make sure the spacer is being used correctly. They check for any barriers to medication adherence and write up a comprehensive evidence-based asthma action plan.
And then the family is sent home with a follow-up appointment.
Yeah, by every single metric of medical education, this is a flawless gold standard clinical encounter.
By the metrics of medical education, sure. But here is the paradox.
Okay.
That child takes their perfectly prescribed inhaler and goes home to a damp, profoundly mold-infested apartment.
Yeah.
And then the next morning, they go to a school that has outdated HVAC systems and literally no plan for indoor air quality when the next wave of seasonal wildfire smoke rolls in.
Because those ambient environmental conditions haven't changed at all.
Right, so the child's airway remains in a state of chronic inflammation. They're inevitably going to end up right back in that same emergency room, struggling to breathe all over again.
So the medical intervention was a complete success, but the health outcome is a total failure,
Exactly.
which introduces what I think, honestly, might be the most important conceptual tool in this entire manuscript.
The competency sufficiency error.
Yes, the competency sufficiency error. Tell us about that.
It is a critical distinction in logic. The error occurs when an institution treats a necessary condition as if it were a sufficient condition.
Okay, break that down for me.
So in this scenario, Excellent clinical judgment is absolutely necessary, right? Mm-hmm. If the doctor misdiagnoses the asthma or gives the wrong dose of medication, the child is in immediate acute danger.
Right. The competence is non-negotiable.
Yes. But that clinical care is not sufficient to generate health.
Because the health depends on other stuff.
Exactly. Health actually depends on a complex web of outside factors. Housing infrastructure, environmental policy, air quality, that fall completely outside the physician's control.
Okay, I have an analogy for this. It's like, imagine you're giving someone the world's absolute best umbrella, just a flawlessly engineered umbrella.
Okay.
That umbrella is the clinical care. It's perfect. But they live in a submarine with a screen door.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The umbrella works exactly as designed, but it's entirely the wrong tool to keep them dry in that specific environment.
That captures the mechanical friction perfectly. We keep handing out better umbrellas and acting shocked when people are still drowning.
Yes. And the component is competent, but the surrounding architecture is catastrophic.
And the danger of this competency sufficiency error is how institutionalized it has become.
How so?
Well, it hides in plain sight within educational frameworks and hospital performance metrics. The paper actually identifies four specific substitutions where institutions quietly shift the burden of systemic failure onto the individual clinician.
Okay. What's the first substitute? Yeah.
The first one is treating knowledge as a substitute for capability.
Right. So teaching a medical resident to identify a problem doesn't actually give them the means to solve it.
Exactly. A resident learns all about the social determinants of health, right?
Right.
They know how to screen for mold exposure. They can accurately check the box on the intake form that says the patient lives in substandard housing.
But naming the mold doesn't remove the mold.
Precisely. Knowledge without jurisdiction is just highly educated observation.
That is so true. What's the second substitution?
The second one is even more pervasive, especially in corporate environments. It's individual responsibility substituting for institutional duty.
Oh, I've seen this, where a hospital expects a frontline trainee to magically compensate for a broken workflow.
Yes. If a clinic refuses to hire a dedicated social worker, they are implicitly demanding that the physician figure out a housing referral during a 15-minute clinical consult.
Which is impossible. It turns a structural resource deficit into a test of the individual's time management skills.
And then there's the third substitution, which deals with advocacy substituting for public authority.
Ah, right. Because in frameworks like HanaMeds, the physician is explicitly trained to be a health advocate.
Which is a noble role.
Yeah, it sounds great.
But exhorting a doctor to advocate for better housing is not a mechanism for actual enforcement.
Right. A doctor writing a strongly worded letter to a landlord cannot exercise the legal powers of a municipal housing inspector.
Exactly. Advocacy is persuasion. Authority is power.
That's a huge distinction. And the fourth substitution.
The fourth, and perhaps the most damaging to the system as a whole, is downstream service substituting for health creation.
Okay. What does that look like in practice?
It occurs when an institution measures its success entirely by its volume of activity rather than its actual impact on the population.
Oh, like measuring how many times the ER successfully treats an asthma attack this quarter.
Exactly. They treat a high volume of successful rescue operations as evidence of a high-functioning system rather than viewing it as a glaring symptom of a failing environment.
Right. They aren't asking why the preventable demand continues to skyrocket. So if the clinician is trapped in this loop, churning through rescue operations because the environment is toxic, how does the system actually course correct?
Well, the knee-jerk reaction in a lot of academic circles is just to expand the doctor's job description.
The logic being, like, the system is broken, therefore the doctor needs to understand municipal housing law and environmental science.
Which is absurd. The framework actively fights against that impulse. Expanding the physician's job description to encompass every social ill just leads to immediate burnout.
And blurred professional boundaries, right?
Yeah, and totally superficial box-ticking assessments. So instead of expanding the individual, the paper introduces a nested recursive architecture of health enablement.
Nested architecture. Okay, let's explore the mechanics of those layers.
It moves away from the idea of the lone heroic healer and visualizes health as a series of interacting concentric fields. Figure one in the text illustrates this beautifully.
Let's start from the inside out. At the very center, you have the actual clinical relationship.
Right. But the framework immediately pushes past basic technical skills and introduces the concept of professional identity formation.
Meaning it's not simply about what a physician knows how to do. It involves the fundamental evolution of who they are becoming.
Because identity determines the boundaries of perception.
Okay, I like that. Explain that a bit more.
Competence is the ability to execute a task, but identity dictates which tasks you recognize as your responsibility in the first place.
Ah, so when that child presents with asthma, does the clinician view the moldy apartment as a vital piece of medical data that requires action?
Exactly. Or do they mentally categorize it as a social problem that is, you know, not my department? Identity broadens that perception, so they see the environmental exposure as an inextricable part of the clinical pathology.
However, having the moral clarity to care about the mold still does not physically fix the apartment.
No, it doesn't. Which pulls us into the next layer, situated agency.
Situated agency. I find this deeply relevant to anyone working in a high-pressure environment.
How so?
Well, having the moral clarity and the professional identity to care about a patient's food insecurity is entirely useless if your clinic forces you to see a new patient every 7 minutes.
That's a fantastic point.
You might have the knowledge, but without protected time, psychological safety, and a functional referral pathway, you possess information without opportunity. You are morally engaged, but operationally paralyzed.
And this naturally expands into the third layer, which is collective competence.
Collective competence.
The author draws on foundational work by researchers like Lingard regarding relational competence. The capability to truly solve a complex problem rarely resides within a single individual.
It exists in the pattern of coordination between professionals, right?
Exactly. In our asthma scenario, a durable solution requires a respiratory educator to monitor lung function, a pharmacist to navigate insurance barriers, a community health worker to interface with the family.
A school nurse to monitor the child during the day.
Right. And the primary care doctor coordinating the medical data. The competence is the network itself.
But networks don't just spring into existence out of thin air. They require the fourth layer, which is institutional capability.
Without a doubt. The clinic needs the physical and digital infrastructure to support that network.
Like, the electronic health record needs to actually have those community referral pathways built into the software.
And the hospital administration must carve out protected paid time for staff to coordinate. There must be formal, funded agreements with community partners.
Because if you lack that institutional capability, you aren't building a system. You are just extracting unpaid emotional labor from exhausted frontline workers.
What's fascinating here is that the way this architecture is constructed serves as a protective mechanism for the clinician.
It explicitly guards against heroic overreach.
Yes. The framework clearly defines the boundary. The physician's role is to recognize the systemic risk, communicate it clearly, provide the necessary medical evidence, and collaborate.
It explicitly states that it is not the physician's job to personally draft municipal housing policy or perform the duties of a building inspector.
Exactly. And wrapping around all of this is the outermost layer, enabling conditions. These draw on the Ottawa Charter's prerequisites for health.
Right. Things like clean air, safe shelter, secure income, a stable ecosystem.
And the crucial shift here is treating these not as background scenery, but as active causal mechanisms.
Right. The absence of clean air is a direct biological trigger for the asthma attack. It operates with the same mechanical certainty as a viral infection.
They are the architecture of causality. And because these are structural causes, they cannot be managed solely through medical gatekeeping.
Housing quality must be guaranteed through public policy and municipal enforcement. It shouldn't suddenly become a priority only when a doctor writes a quote-unquote prescription for a dry apartment.
Precisely. So to navigate this massive web of intersecting layers without becoming totally paralyzed by the complexity, the paper introduces an operational grammar.
This is the really practical part, the LIFE framework, L-I-F-E.
Yes. It's designed as a nonlinear recursive loop, not a checklist, meaning you are constantly iterating through the stages as the environment shifts.
Let's break down the mechanics of these four steps, starting with L.
L stands for life. The fundamental question is, what specific condition of human life, dignity, or ecology must be protected or enabled?
And the framework demands absolute specificity here, right?
Total specificity.
Right.
A vague institutional goal, like improving community wellness, is functionally useless.
Because it can't be measured or governed. So in the context of the asthma tracer, the L is highly specific.
Right. It is the ability to breathe without obstruction, the capacity for uninterrupted sleep, the physical ability to attend school, and the preservation of family security.
It anchors the entire process in the physical, lived reality of the patient rather than an abstract hospital metric.
Exactly. Following that, L stands for influences.
Okay, influences.
Which intersecting conditions are actually producing the threat to life? This involves biological, commercial, social, and ecological factors.
But the objective is not to map out every single theoretical determinant in the universe, right? Because that would immediately paralyze any clinical team.
Exactly. The objective is to isolate the few most consequential, changeable influences operating in this specific scenario.
So for the asthma patient, the primary influences are medication accessibility, the presence of indoor mold, and the acute exposure to seasonal wildfire smoke.
Right. Now, here is where the framework gets sharp. The F stands for fit.
Fit. This is the one I really want to emphasize.
It demands that we match the proposed action to the legitimate authority.
Who actually possesses the competence, the legal jurisdiction, the financial resources, and the operational power to change the influence?
This is how you short-circuit the competency sufficiency error. You stop asking a medical resident to fix housing, and you ask, who actually has the power to compel a landlord to remediate a building?
It forces transparency regarding jurisdiction. If a hospital realizes they lack the legal authority to enforce air quality standards in a local school, FIT requires them to identify the agency that does possess that authority.
And then establish a formal mechanism to transmit their clinical evidence to that agency.
Right. And the final step is E for evidence.
Yes. What actually occurred in reality? Not just do we hold a multidisciplinary meeting, but what was the tangible outcome for the human being?
Did the lung function actually improve? What was the financial and logistical burden placed on the family to achieve that outcome?
And most importantly, what were the unintended harms?
Yeah, this is huge. Like, did a well-meaning medical intervention, like reporting the mold to the city, accidentally trigger an eviction notice?
Right, because the landlord realized it was cheaper to empty the unit than to repair the walls.
That happens more often than people think.
It does. And the integration of evidence in this manner is heavily influenced by John McMurtry's life-grounded philosophy,
which argues that value should be measured by the extent to which vital capacities are protected and expanded, rather than measuring value through economic efficiency or administrative throughput.
Exactly. This philosophy distills the framework into three core interlocking commitments: treat, prevent, and enable.
Treat the immediate threat to life, prevent the recurrent harm, enable the conditions necessary for life to thrive.
And the sequence matters. You don't withhold the rescue inhaler because you are busy trying to dismantle the capitalist housing market.
Right. You execute the medical rescue immediately.
But the moment the patient is biologically stabilized, the system must pivot to preventing the recurrent exposure and enabling the long-term environment.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me, though. How do you define fit in the real world when multiple agencies are involved and everyone just wants to pass the buck?
Well, the real-world application is definitely complex because fit rarely aligns perfectly. Municipal budgets are stretched thin. Bureaucratic entities are notorious for passing the buck, as you said. Yeah. So to illustrate how this distributed accountability functions mechanically, the paper maps out the asthma tracer across four distinct domains of authority. This is in Table 2 of the manuscript.
Let's trace that signal path. Walk me through the matrix.
Okay. In the clinical domain, the fit is the treating physician and the patient's family.
So the jurisdiction is purely medical.
Exactly. The doctor optimizes the pharmacological therapy, trains the family on the inhaler technique, and secures informed consent. Their accountability is entirely bounded by their clinical capability.
Okay, that makes sense. Then where does it go?
Moving to the team and community domain, the fit involves social workers, community health nurses, and potentially medical legal partnerships.
So their jurisdiction involves care coordination and navigating the social safety net.
Right. They might assess the family's tenancy rights, but they must do so safely, ensuring that their intervention won't provoke retaliation from a landlord.
Then the signal crosses into the housing and school domain. This is where we leave medical jurisdiction entirely.
Completely. The fit here involves the property owner, the school administration, and local public health officials.
The landlord holds the legal accountability for the physical remediation of the dampness. The school administration is accountable for implementing indoor clean air protocols.
And the paper points out that entities like Health Canada provide specific guidance for creating cleaner air spaces during wildfire events. These aren't abstract concepts.
They're existing operational guidelines that school boards actually possess the authority to implement.
Precisely. Finally, the signal reaches the public governance domain. The fit here belongs to authorized public agencies and elected officials.
Because they hold the ultimate authority to enforce housing standards, allocate funding for school infrastructure, and address zoning policies.
What this mapping achieves is the formalization of the proportionality principle.
Right. So a physician's accountability is strictly proportionate to their clinical power, and a housing authority's accountability is proportionate to their legal power. It makes me think of a high-stakes relay race. The doctor runs the first leg perfectly. But if there's no one to pass the baton to, if there's no institutional fit, the baton just gets dropped.
Exactly.
It's a system failure, not a runner failure. If a circuit board fails, you don't automatically blame the processor. The microchip, the clinician, processed the diagnostic signal perfectly.
But if the physical copper trace connecting the chip to the output is severed, the signal dies. The overall architecture failed, but the chip operated exactly as designed.
This is why the framework is so adamant about making political resistance visible, isn't it?
Yes, drawing heavily on public health scholarship regarding the political economy of health. If a property development lobby actively blocks tenant protections, or if a school board claims clean air is unaffordable, that political resistance must be documented as a causal factor in the patient's recurring illness.
If you don't document the severed connection in the circuit board, the system will inevitably blame the microchip for the failure.
It protects the medical team from absorbing the blame for a political failure. And equally, it protects the patient from being labeled non-compliant when their physical environment is actively sabotaging their recovery.
Okay, asthma provides a relatively clean illustration because the environmental trigger, like mold or smoke, is highly localized. But to truly stress test this framework, the manuscript introduces a much more entangled scenario.
Yes, it shifts the focus to cardiometabolic disease and the global food system.
This is the second clinical tracer. It involves an adult working irregular shift hours. They present with type 2 diabetes, central adiposity, and a high risk of future cardiovascular events.
And furthermore, they're experiencing chronic food insecurity, meaning they lack consistent financial or logistical access to nutritious food.
This is not a localized structural issue like a single moldy apartment. It is a massive systemic knot involving global supply chains, labor laws, and commercial markets.
And faced with a knot that massive, there's a temptation in some progressive academic circles to view clinical medicine as a mere band-aid and argue that we should abandon pharmacological interventions in favor of purely upstream policy reform.
But the framework fiercely rejects this, right?
Completely. It explicitly defends the necessity of medical intervention, and it heavily references the SELECT trial to make this point.
Ah, the SELECT trial. Let's talk about that.
It is a landmark piece of evidence. It investigated the effects of semaglutide, which many people know is a GLP-1 receptor agonist, commonly discussed for weight management and diabetes.
Right.
They studied it on adults who had pre-existing cardiovascular disease and overweight or obesity, but crucially, who did not have a diabetes diagnosis.
And the mechanics of the results are what make it so vital to this discussion. The trial showed that administering once-weekly semaglutide reduced the incidence of major adverse cardiovascular events, meaning heart attacks, strokes, or cardiovascular deaths.
It reduced it from 8.0% in the placebo group down to 6.5% in the treatment group over a period of roughly 40 months.
A 1.5% absolute risk reduction over that time frame for such severe endpoints is highly significant at a population level. That represents thousands of lives protected from catastrophic health events.
The paper is careful to note the nuances, of course. There were higher rates of adverse events leading to discontinuation in the treatment group, so it is not a universally applicable miracle cure.
But the core philosophical point stands.
Yes. These medications exert a profound biological protection over human life. A life-grounded approach dictates that you cannot ethically deny a patient a highly effective biological shield simply because you believe the ultimate root cause of their disease is the structure of the global food economy.
Treating the disease is not the error. The error is using a successful pharmaceutical intervention as an excuse to ignore the structural forces producing the disease in the first place. But if we acknowledge that the structural forces are producing the disease, how does a clinician practically address the food system during a medical consult?
Well, the traditional simplified answer has been food prescribing.
Right, where the doctor writes a prescription for fresh produce, like broccoli, and hands the patient a voucher for a local farmer's market.
But the paper pushes back hard on this approach, citing recent analyses that highlight the severe limitations of food prescriptions.
Because it medicalizes a socioeconomic problem. You cannot treat systemic food insecurity as a patient's failed education about nutrition.
Exactly. It shifts reliance onto precarious, underfunded charity models rather than secure public infrastructure. If a shift worker explains that they physically do not have the time to prepare whole foods between their two jobs, or that fresh produce is prohibitively expensive in their neighborhood.
Handing them an educational pamphlet on the benefits of leafy greens does not alter the commercial reality they live in.
It doesn't. And when we look at that commercial reality, the manuscript dives deeply into the commercial determinants of health.
Yeah, it highlights a fascinating inpatient crossover trial by Hall et al. To explain the exact biological mechanism at play here.
Oh, this trial is incredible.
Let's break it down. Researchers took a group of adults and housed them in a highly controlled clinical environment for a month.
For 2 weeks, the participants were offered a diet consisting entirely of ultra-processed foods.
And for the other 2 weeks, they were offered a diet of unprocessed whole foods.
But the critical mechanic of the trial was that the diets were matched for calories, sugar, fat, and fiber, and the participants were allowed to eat ad libitum.
Meaning they could eat as much or as little as they wanted throughout the day.
Right. And the results demonstrated the raw power of commercial formulation over human biology.
What happened?
When participants were on the ultra-processed diet, they unconsciously consumed roughly 500 additional kilocalories per day compared to when they were on the unprocessed diet.
500 extra calories a day, just unconsciously.
Yes, leading to rapid weight gain in just 2 weeks. The foods are literally engineered to bypass the body's natural satiety signals.
It is a profound demonstration of how the commercial environment directly drives biological outcomes.
However, the framework demands rigorous precision here. It cautions against the oversimplified demonization of all processed foods.
Right, because that specific trial proves a causal effect under specific conditions, but it does not mean every item produced by the food industry is inherently toxic.
Exactly. Many processed foods are highly affordable, heavily fortified with essential nutrients, and microbiologically safe, which is vital for food security.
The goal is not to declare war on the concept of processing food. The goal is to target the specific, harmful commercial practices.
Like predatory marketing to children. Or the deliberate engineering of hyperpalatable nutrient-poor formulations, while acknowledging that working-class populations require accessible, affordable nutrition.
And as if balancing commercial formulation, labor economics, and clinical pharmacology wasn't complex enough, the framework expands outward one more time to encompass planetary health.
Because the agricultural systems producing our food are simultaneously accelerating the climate crisis.
Right. The global agri-food system is responsible for roughly 32% of all global anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions.
That is an astonishing ecological burden. It forces a reckoning with ecological limits.
But if we connect this to the broader philosophy of the paper, it exposes a massive, often unspoken tension within the planetary health movement.
Yes. You cannot apply a singular carbon-focused metric to mandate a universal planetary diet for the entire human population.
Because optimizing purely for carbon emission reduction might lead a policymaker to advocate for the elimination of all local animal agriculture in a specific region, replacing it with imported, heavily processed, plant-based alternatives.
But if that low-emission diet is financially unaffordable for the local population, nutritionally inadequate for their specific biological needs, or culturally exclusionary, it fundamentally fails the life-grounded test.
Ecological sustainability is vital, but it must be evaluated alongside human dignity, economic reality, and regional sovereignty. Carbon cannot be the sole dictator of public policy.
Absolutely.
Which brings us back to the clinicians sitting in the exam room with the shift worker. So what does this all mean for the clinician? If they aren't supposed to fight the global agriculture lobby or just hand out broccoli prescriptions, what is their actual lane here?
Their lane is strictly defined by the concept of fit. The clinician's jurisdiction is clinical care. They provide the necessary pharmacological therapy. They manage the immediate cardiovascular and metabolic risk. And they fiercely protect the patient's dignity and bodily autonomy.
And at the institutional level?
The hospital network leverages its power to coordinate food support with trusted community partners and audits its own internal procurement policies. But the actual systemic levers, national fiscal policies, agricultural subsidies, WHO healthy school food environment guidelines, that authority rests firmly with public agencies and elected governments.
So the clinician's structural role is to systematically aggregate the data regarding the unmet needs they see in the clinic and transmit that evidence up the chain of command to the actors who actually possess the legal and financial authority to change the system. That transition from individual data collection to systemic authority leads directly into one of the most rigorously argued sections of the manuscript. the absolute necessity of indigenous food sovereignty and distinctions-based practice.
Yes, the paper is incredibly strict on this point. Indigenous health is not just another bullet point under the social determinants of health.
It cannot be reduced to a cultural competency module that a medical student clicks through online.
It requires a fundamental paradigm shift regarding jurisdiction and power. The framework insists that institutions must recognize First Nations, Inuit, and Métis not merely as marginalized populations, but as distinct peoples.
With unique histories, inherent rights, complex knowledge systems, and most crucially, legal and political jurisdiction over their own territories and data.
You cannot amalgamate them into a generic, vulnerable population category, and you cannot use Indigenous participation merely as a performative rubber stamp to lend a veneer of equity to an initiative designed entirely by a colonial hospital system.
A perfect mechanism illustrating this distinction is the Inuit Nonangit Food Security Strategy, right?
Yes. It was developed by the organization representing Inuit across Canada, and it frames the concept of food security entirely through the lens of self-determination.
It doesn't focus on integrating into southern Canadian grocery supply chains.
No. It focuses on the protection of local harvesting rights, access to traditional country food, adapting to aggressive climate-related changes in the Arctic ecosystem, and establishing the authority of Inuit to dictate their own research priorities.
If a well-meaning academic institution uses a blanket planetary health model to suggest that Inuit communities should stop harvesting local country food because an imported, lab-grown substitute has a theoretically lower carbon footprint on a spreadsheet.
That model is not just mathematically flawed. It is actively perpetuating colonial harm by undermining their culture, their health, and their sovereignty.
Respecting that sovereignty requires an absolute overhaul of how medical institutions handle evidence and data collection. The paper highlights the First Nations Food, Nutrition, and Environment Study,
which systematically documented severe levels of household food insecurity on reserve. But the critical lesson is not just the findings themselves. It is the data governance model underlying the research.
This introduces the OCAP principles. OCAP.
Yes, which are a registered trademark of the First Nations Information Governance Center. OCA stands for Ownership, Control, Access, and Possession.
Let's dive into the mechanics of OCAP, because this is revolutionary for anyone working in digital health, AI, or epidemiology. It fundamentally changes the ownership structure of information.
Exactly. Ownership asserts that a community collectively owns their cultural and health information in the same way an individual owns their personal health information.
And control.
Control dictates that First Nations must have the authority to dictate how their data is collected, used, and interpreted at every stage of a project.
And the distinction between access and possession is where the actual mechanical power lies, right?
Yes. Access means First Nations must have unfettered access to information about themselves, regardless of where it is held. But possession goes a step further.
It means the community physically or digitally holds the data themselves.
Right. A hospital or university research department cannot simply build a sophisticated digital dashboard, extract terabytes of health data from a First Nations community, run their own proprietary algorithms on it, and publish the results without explicit structural consent and ongoing governance.
The ethical legitimacy of the data is completely inseparable from the decision-making authority of the people it describes. If you extract data without granting control over its interpretation, you aren't doing public health research.
You are executing a digital form of resource extraction.
Wow. It is entirely about the mechanics of power. The manuscript uses a highly instructive historical precedent to drive this home, the Kanawha.E School's Diabetes Prevention Project.
This was an internationally recognized model of intervention developed in deep partnership with the Kanyen-Kiha-Got-A community.
It possessed robust, authentic community governance, heavily integrated local knowledge, and implemented extensive school-based activities. It was essentially the gold standard for community-led intervention.
It was. But the long-term results, published after 8 years of operation, revealed a deeply sobering reality.
The initial promising improvements in health markers were not fully maintained over the long term.
Right, and broader trends related to obesity and cardiometabolic risk remained stubbornly challenging to reverse.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, this proves that even incredible community leadership cannot independently overcome the sheer gravitational pull of macroeconomic commercial environments and global food system pressures.
That's exactly the takeaway. The fading of those results does not mean that community governance was a failure. It actually validates the central thesis of the entire LIFE framework.
It doesn't mean community governance failed. It means institutions must supply sustained, enabling structural support. Community governance is vital, but it is not a magical shield against a multi-billion dollar ultra-processed food industry.
You cannot simply hand a massive systemic problem back to a marginalized community under the guise of empowerment while actively denying them the macroeconomic levers required to succeed.
I think the clearest way to express this dynamic is that consultation is not consent. Asking a community for feedback on a health plan that a hospital administration has already written is like handing someone a menu at a restaurant and asking them for their thoughts.
That is a highly accurate translation of the power dynamic.
True governance is letting them run the kitchen, letting them design the menu, and having the power to look at the ingredients and say, no, we are not serving this at all. The power to veto is the foundation of genuine authority.
And it leads us directly into the logistical mechanics of the framework. A profound philosophical shift regarding jurisdiction and data ownership is intellectually satisfying, but how does a hospital administrator actually implement this on a random Tuesday morning when they are dealing with a packed ER and a budget deficit?
Yes. The practical side. The paper provides highly specific operational tools, beginning with the life constraints audit. Tell us about this audit.
The mechanics are brilliant in their simplicity. It takes the four pillars, life, influences, fit, evidence, and forces the institutional leadership to rate their proposed intervention or current workflow using a strict green, amber, red traffic light system.
Okay, so a green rating.
A green rating means the required element, whether it is a data sharing agreement or a referral pathway, is fully documented, funded, and currently operational.
And amber.
An amber rating indicates that the evidence is incomplete, or the authority is ambiguous, requiring immediate clarification.
And red is the critical fail-safe.
Yes. It signifies that a necessary condition, a source of funding, or a legitimate decision-maker is entirely absent from the plan.
Let's apply that to a Tuesday morning reality. If a hospital launches a massive screening program for housing insecurity among pediatric asthma patients, but they haven't established any formal relationship with the municipal housing authority,
the fit category for that program scores a hard red.
So what does a red actually do? It doesn't mean the doctors stop treating asthma.
No, it forces the administration to explicitly acknowledge the bureaucratic friction. It forces them to say out loud on the record, we are mandating that our clinicians screen for this problem, but we have built absolutely zero infrastructure to solve it.
It prevents the institution from claiming success just because they printed a new screening form.
Exactly. Bound tightly to the audit is the concept of the institutional premortem.
I love the institutional premortem. How does that work?
Before launching any new community health initiative, the leadership team must convene and ask a deliberately provocative question.
Which is, if this fails in 6 months, what missing condition or unfunded partner will explain the failure?
It forces the institution to proactively map the structural weaknesses before they demand that their frontline staff execute the plan.
It forces you to actually inspect the submarine for screen doors before you spend $500,000 manufacturing perfectly waterproof umbrellas.
Perfect analogy.
Yeah.
And this entire audit process maps directly onto the updated CAN-MD's 2026 roles, defining the boundaries of professional obligation.
Let's run through those roles quickly. The medical expert role.
They are responsible for accurate diagnosis and evidence-based treatment. But that expertise does not magically confer the jurisdiction to rewrite zoning laws.
The health advocate role.
Responsible for marshaling clinical evidence to highlight systemic harms. But advocacy is not the same mechanism as public policy enforcement.
And the leader role.
Responsible for the ethical stewardship of medical resources. But demonstrating leadership does not excuse the broader institution from its obligation to actually fund the staff and provide the protected time required to coordinate care.
To demonstrate how these constraints and boundaries operate in reality, the manuscript outlines a prospective, hypothetical demonstration at the University of Ottawa, deliberately timed to align with the 2026 International Conference on Residency Education.
The author is entirely transparent that this is an illustrative proposal based on publicly available data, not a covert institutional partnership. They utilize the 2026 Planetary Health Report Card,
which gave the school an overall grade of a B, demonstrating genuine institutional commitment. But the report card also exposed glaring structural gaps.
Right. The institution scored a 0 out of 3 on integrating indigenous knowledge systems into their planetary health curriculum, and a 1 out of 3 on ensuring that communities disproportionately impacted by climate change possess the authority to directly shape the research agenda.
Those scores highlight the exact systemic flaws the LIFE framework is engineered to resolve. The paper proposes a 4-part bounded demonstration. Phase 1 involves the recurrent asthma tracer, linking clinical teaching to municipal partners for housing and schools.
Phase 2 implements the cardiometabolic tracer, tracing clinical outcomes of food insecurity directly to the university's internal procurement policies.
And Phase 3 targets the 0 out of 3 score regarding Indigenous integration. It establishes a dedicated governance workstream.
Meaning, the institution must establish rights-respecting community governance agreements, fully compensate community partners, and secure legally binding Indigenous data protocols before a single piece of clinical research data is collected.
The mechanism of power is reversed. You build the governance structure first, and the community dictates what the research project will be.
Finally, Phase 4 introduces an evaluation workstream.
Right, rigorously comparing the patient-relevant outcomes against the administrative friction required to implement it. But the author knows this is a radical departure from the status quo, so the paper actively stress tests its own logic.
These 5 stress tests are the firewall against mission creep and institutional theater.
Let's run through them. Test 1.
Clinical rescue versus upstream prevention. The absolute rule is that an institution must never delay necessary acute care in the name of policy reform.
Test 2.
Complexity versus usability. Focus only on a few consequential influences. Don't paralyze the clinician.
Test 3. This is the one that will make every hospital CFO sweat.
Prevention versus cost-saving certainty. Don't falsely promise that prevention will always save money. Acknowledge true opportunity costs. Sometimes it just costs money to improve human health, and that has to be okay.
Test 4.
Environmental versus equity. Don't optimize carbon at the expense of human dignity, affordability, or sovereignty.
And test 5.
Participation versus authority. Realize that a seat at the advisory table is not actual power. Real authority is who can halt the process entirely.
And this leads to what I consider the most intellectually honest part of the entire manuscript. The paper concludes by offering a falsifiable research agenda.
This raises an important question regarding academic models. Mm. If a model cannot be proven wrong, it isn't science, it's dogma.
The author explicitly outlines the conditions under which the framework should be considered a failure. If an independent evaluation demonstrates that teaching the LIFE framework actually generates more confusion and uncompensated administrative burden than just giving them a standard checklist, then the framework fails.
The ultimate test is whether a proposed intervention reduces the burden on patients and trainees. If a simpler approach achieves better biological outcomes with less friction, the author readily admits we should throw the LIFE framework in the trash.
That is a profound demonstration of intellectual humility. We have covered a massive amount of conceptual ground here. We started in an ER with a single child struggling to breathe.
We traced the failure of that perfect medical intervention out into the moldy apartment.
Scaled it up to the carbon footprint of the global food supply chain, navigated the complex legal mechanics of Indigenous data sovereignty, and landed on a highly pragmatic traffic light audit system designed to force bureaucratic honesty.
And the entire philosophy boils down to a complementary mandate. Treat the immediate threat, prevent the recurrent harm, and enable the conditions for life to thrive.
Competence in your specific role is absolutely necessary. But true, sustainable success requires a system built on distributed accountability.
It requires an architecture where the microchip is perfectly engineered, but the copper traces connecting it to the rest of the board are equally maintained, funded, and legally protected.
So I want to turn this directly over to you, listening right now. Take this framework and apply it to your own profession. Are you committing the competency sufficiency error? Are you constantly machining better, shinier pistons and dropping them into an engine with no oil?
Are you expecting your frontline workers' competence to magically compensate for missing enabling conditions in your business?
Building on that vital distinction between merely participating in a system and actually possessing the authority to govern it, I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on.
Something beyond the paper.
Yeah. We talk endlessly about treating patients, and we talk about changing policies, but we are rapidly accelerating into a future dominated by artificial intelligence and digital health tracking. What if the most revolutionary structural intervention of the next decade isn't a new drug or a surgical technique?
What if it is a radical legal transfer of health data ownership entirely back to patients and communities?
If data is the new soil of healthcare, who actually owns the harvest? Think about that child in the ER with asthma. Are we merely going to build a more sophisticated AI algorithm to predict the exact date of their next hospital visit so we can staff the ER more efficiently?
Or are we going to build a system that gives them the power to fundamentally change the air they breathe?
Exactly. Until next time, keep diving deep.